Hello, Ann Hobbs, to the principal's office, please. Right away. Your mother is waiting.
Will you please let us know in the outer office whether you can hear? There appears to be some interest in German reunification. But also interest, Mr. Ambassador, in your illuminating the subject of where reunification will lead us. Ambassador von Staden, as most of you know, was born and lived as a youth in independent Estonia. He was ambassador of the Federal Republic to the United States from 1973 to 1979. From 1979 to 1981, he was national security advisor, in quotes, to Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. Some pundit has said he was Schmidt's Kissinger, and another one has remarked that Kissinger was Nixon's von Staden. He then became State Secretary to Foreign Minister Genscher from 1981 to 83, the top career officer and number two man in the Foreign Office. He retired in 1983, and since 1985 has served as visiting professor at Georgetown University, among a number of other activities and functions in which he's engaged. It's a great privilege, Mr. Ambassador, to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm afraid Kissinger wouldn't like what you said, but I hope he's not here. thank you very much for thank you very much for inviting me to address this very distinguished group today. It is to us Germans very important to have such opportunities at this point in time to make our views known. It is a fascinating time, and there are many misunderstandings around, cliches around, and then things are moving so fast, incredibly fast. When I was invited a couple of weeks ago to come over here, I started to prepare a text, as I should, and I have it here before my eyes, but more as a kind of insurance, because it's all overtaken by events, and so with your permission I will speak without my notes and try to address the subject independently of what I put down. When I came over in January, we still thought we would have time to do all this gradually and in step with European developments and with the building up of a new European order and what have you. But it turns out that we have no such time. Things are speeding up much more than we want them to speed up, but this is mainly due to the fact that the people in the eastern part of Germany become more and more impatient and frustrated, and that the mass exodus from east to west continues at a pace of about 2,000 a day. We had more than 300,000 from East Germany, not just refugees, that's not the right word, but people who wanted to come over. Last year, and since January 1st, already more than 100,000 again. And this cannot go on. I mean, we have been lucky in the West, we were able, under American protection, to build up a very prosperous society, but they are less lucky, and if this mass exodus continues, then we might have a collapse of the economy in the East, and in particular, collapse of the services. The health service is already in very bad shape, and I have been told that Medicare is not anymore guaranteed. And so, consequently, we are now willing to start immediate talks about a monetary union, economic and monetary union with East Germany, and immediately after the elections, which will take place on the 18th of March in East Germany, we'll start talks about the establishment of unity. And this, of course, may take some time, but the important thing is to give people a perspective. And it's quite obvious from all the polls we know that the vast majority of the East Germans want to be united with the rest of us. But this, of course, is not everywhere looked upon with great delight. I mean, there are many concerns which are voiced by neighbors in the East, but partially also in the West, least in the United States. You are not only very good friends, but probably it's also because you are a great power, and you look at it from some more, emotionally speaking at least, with some more distance than our immediate neighbors who somehow feel we may grow too big. And there are some questions here which I would like to address, which I think should be addressed. Let me say at the outset, whatever happens over the last month, and I'm not going to predict the calendar, I'm not going to predict when this or that act could take place, when unity is established. That's very difficult to say. It's even very difficult to say how long it will take to establish monetary union. I personally think all this will happen rather quickly and may even happen before the end of this year, but I would hesitate to make any predictions. But what I want to say at the outset is that whatever happens, the new Germany will be something very different, I would even say entirely different, from what Germany was in the past. And this for essentially for two reasons. One reason is we have built up a democratic society based on the rule of law. We have been for over 40 years reliable and predictable allies and friends. We have, I think, really learned. Nations can learn as individuals can learn. But there is one second reason as well, and that is a more factual thing. Whatever happens, Prussia, which dominated Germany until 1945, is gone. And it is gone for good. It cannot be reestablished because one third of Prussia today is Polish territory. One third in the West has become the states. You would say states. We say Länder. The states of Lower Saxony and North Rhine-Westphalia, and they would never be willing to become Prussian provinces again. So Prussia is gone, and for the first time since the Reformation. For the first time since more than 400 years, the center of gravity of Germany has shifted from the east to the west, to the west and south. That is quite a difference. It is simply not the same. Quite apart from our being fully integrated in NATO. I will come back to this in a moment. And quite apart from or being integrated in the European community as well, and committed to the increasing surrender of national sovereignty. So whatever the future may be, it will be entirely different from the past. And I underline this because very often in comments, in reports, you find the idea that people are concerned it could be again the old Germany. And I'm even not talking about Nazi Germany. I'm even not talking about the Hitler years, but the old Reich as it was, which created a disequilibrium in Europe. That cannot be again. We are really anchored to international organizations, not only the Atlantic Alliance, as I said, but the European community as well. Still, some questions remain which we are asked and which we have to answer. Now, here I have to make a short remark. What do I mean if I say we, or if I say our views, our opinions? I do not speak anymore for a government, and I don't speak for a party, because I am not a member of any of our parties. I think there's a difference here between the American civil service and ours. We can be members of a party, but I never was, and I always thought it would be better for a career official to be able to serve any democratic government which must have confidence in him. So I didn't join a party. So what I give you is, of course, my own views, but what I'm going to say, I think, corresponds to the views of a very broad spectrum of people in the political center, whether a little bit right of the center or left of the center. And my views as far as foreign policy are concerned are not identical, but very close to those of my former foreign minister, Genscher, whom I consider a very experienced and a wise man. So among the questions which I should like to address, the first one is the one that much debated question of the Polish border. You can read about that, I think, now every day in the newspapers. And on this one, I want to be particularly clear. The western border of Poland is a settled issue. Or in other words, if I express it otherwise, it is a non-issue because it is settled. So why are our Polish neighbors nervous, and why is there so much debate about it? It's primarily, the situation is as follows. Both German states are committed by treaty to recognize the border and to renounce any territorial claims for any future. But I'm not a lawyer myself. Well, I studied law, but I never worked as a lawyer. But lawyers who always find a problem everywhere say that doesn't yet bind a future all German government and all German parliament, and that it has to be confirmed in due form by a parliament elected by everybody and then representing the nation as a whole and the resulting government. And these institutions are not in place. They cannot yet be in place. And that, I think, is the real problem. I mean, Chancellor Kohl I guess, has also a domestic problem, a problem with his elections in fall. But, and I will come back to this for just in just a moment, but the main problem is we cannot do it presently. If we did anything, then our Polish neighbors would come back to us after the elections and said, now you have to conclude a new treaty with us, because we are, cannot be sure that whatever you do now will be binding upon a future German government representing the whole of the nation. Now, Chancellor Kohl's problem, I want you to talk about that also a little bit. He has never said so, but I think it's a good guess that he has a domestic problem related to forthcoming elections, which will take place in December. And in this context, you can read about Kohl taking account of the fact that there are 8 to 10 million refugees, or it's more precise to say expellees, from the East and their descendants, etc., etc. Well, that's true, and at the same time, it's not true. I am not myself a refugee from the East. I'm from the Baltics, as you know, but our fate was not too different. I mean, we can feel how these people feel. It's never easy to lose your ancestral home. Actually, those who have revisionist ideas are a very small minority within these refugees and expellees. It is my best guess, and please believe me, that at least 90, and I think probably it is more, it's about 95%, of our people accept the present Polish border as definitive. And it's only a small minority. Now, we have this extremist right-wing party. It's not an outright Nazi party. That would be wrong. It is has elements of Pujadism in it and all kinds of course, there are old Nazis as well in it. The last poll I've seen, and which is about 10 days old, says that if we had elections next Sunday, they would get about 3% of the vote. Now, you need, under our constitution, you need 5% of the vote in order to be represented in parliament. And so we are actually not talking about 8 to 10 million refugees. We are talking about 2% of the vote, which is quite a different number. I have dwelt on this for some length of time for the very simple reason that it is the question which these days you can find every day again in the news, and I want in conclusion to say once more, the Polish border issue is settled, and you will see the moment the East German elections are over, both parliaments, the West German and the East German parliament, both freely elected, will pass a joint resolution, and the moment a parliament is elected for the whole of the nation, we will have in due form a new treaty with Poland signed and ratified. The second issue I want to deal with is security. Because security, again, you have seen the Soviet proposal to, or demand, that the new unified Germany should be neutral, or I prefer to say neutralized, because in case it would be imposed neutrality, which is not quite the same as voluntary neutrality, like in the case of Sweden or Switzerland, neutralized, and you have seen that our own government has rejected the idea, and the Western allies have rejected it as well. Now, does that mean that everything can remain as it is, as it presently is, full membership in NATO, and that's it? Well, I do not think so. I think my own guess is the development will be somewhat different, and as far as I can see, this development is already beginning. It's already perceptible. Let me explain what I mean. There is, on the one side, I would say we are certainly not witnessing the end of history, as some people feel. The Soviet Union is still a great power, it's still a nuclear power, it's still in Europe and will remain in Europe. So we are not witnessing the end of history, but the tremendous changes which take place are undeniable, and it would be quite irresponsible and unhistorical not to take account of it. So what can we do? I think what we can do, and what we already begin to do, is build up a kind of cooperative security structure in Europe, seeking security not against each other, but seeking security with each other. Not in trying to be stronger than the other guy, but in trying to de-escalate armaments together in a balanced way. Not giving away any unilateral advantages. That's not the point. Not making any unilateral concessions, but trying to de-escalate the situation in Europe, where, after all, you had by far the largest concentration of armed forces in the history of mankind, on both sides, and primarily on the eastern side, and I would say an unreasonable concentration of armaments. So what begins to emerge in the Vienna talks, you have seen the agreement reached between Secretary Baker and Foreign Minister Shevardnadze about the troop ceilings, and this is only one element. There's a second conference on confidence building measures, which are an important part of the picture. What you see is a slow transformation of the alliances. They become more political. The focus is more on disarmament and armed control verification. The relationship is less confrontational. Who would have thought only 2-3 years ago that the leading military people from the Soviet Union and the Western countries would sit together in Vienna for a symposium for 2 weeks to discuss strategy? This is not yet the real thing. What's the impression you use? Where is the beef, I think you say? We still have to see. We still have to see the beef. But the willingness is there, and we can perceive first Soviet moves, and then some of these moves are not just voluntary. You have seen the agreement signed by this great man, Václav Havel, with Gorbachev in Moscow about the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Czechoslovakia. So it's beginning to happen. And my prediction is that, and that is the view of Mr. Genscher, but I think it's shared by the Chancellor as well, and certainly by the Social Democratic Opposition, my prediction is we will continue to build up such cooperative security structures, which begin slowly to overarch the alliances, and maybe one day in the future, and this will certainly take many years, into which maybe one day the alliances could even be absorbed. But that's not for tomorrow. That may last a long time. Anyway, that should be the general direction into which I think we should move, and that, I think, answers in the last analysis the question of German neutrality, which would not be in anybody's interest. I mean, to cut us loose, to force us to float between East and West, to force us to build up national, non-integrated forces strong enough for self-defense would be counterproductive, would certainly not be in the interest of our neighbors, East and West. Let me give you only one example. If we would be neutralized and if we would be forced to form national forces strong enough for self-defense, we would force Poland to remain in the Warsaw Pact forever. We would force Poland to invite Soviet troops to stay in Poland forever. Unavoidable. If, on the other hand, we would be firmly anchored to the integrated structures of NATO, if at the same time what is today the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, would be demilitarized, in such a case, the Poles, I think, could invite the Soviets to leave, because there would be no problem for them, no security problem for them. But this is only one example. I think in the long run, we have to try to persuade the Soviets that a structure similar to the present is in the best interest, as Kissinger, I think, has rightly pointed out. And I'm personally convinced what we have heard from Moscow until now is not the last word. And let me add at this point one remark concerning you, or American allies and or American friends. I think it's unavoidable and not objectionable that your presence will be diminished in Europe. This will happen. I mean, it is a president's program, and for good reasons, and the Congress will also, I think, insist on it. But I think it's of tremendous importance that you do not leave altogether. As I said, we are not at the end of history. And there can be no balance in Europe without an American presence. And so I think this is tremendously important, and we have to find ways or you have to find ways, I hope, to continue an American presence in Europe. Complete withdrawal, which was the goals concept, as you may remember, very early, 20 years ago, complete withdrawal of American troops, I think, would be a great tragedy and should not happen. And this is not some people will say, well, this is old thinking in terms of the old blocs and power politics and all that. Now, that's not old thinking. I mean, we are quite willing, as I said, to try to build up new security structures. But in doing so, on the way to this goal, we want to be on the safe side. And it would be unreasonable to pay in terms of security at a time where this is not warranted and really more destabilizing than useful. I have already taken too much of your time, but I want to allow as much time as possible for a discussion, which I hope we'll have afterwards. Let me only say very few words with regard to European integration, because European integration, I think, is the second really important issue. I said the Polish border question was not a real issue because it was actually settled, but security is one and European integration is certainly also one. And if you hear concerns about the dominating role of the United Germany in Europe, they are mostly not formulated in terms of military might. I mean, most people are reasonable enough to know that we could never be a military great power again, being a really narrow, overpopulated country and entirely dependent on foreign trade and not possessing nuclear weapons. But people say Germany would have a dominating role economically, a dominating role in Europe, but dominate Europe economically. Well, we will have considerable weight, there's no doubt about that. But whoever has concerns about that should press ahead with European integration with all energy and not put on brakes. That's exactly the wrong thing to do, and I think most continental statesmen have understood it, and let's hope that everybody will finally understand it. That's the way to go. We in a community of 340 million, if the GDR is included, it would be 340 million, and we would be altogether about 76 million. In a community of 340, we could not play a dominating role, and in particular not, because the institutions of the community, which is after all a supranational body, do not allow for the emergence of any dominating position. You have a council of ministers which takes most of its decisions by a majority vote. Presently we have 10 votes out of 76. Well, let's assume after unification we get 12 votes. That may be. Then it would 12 out of 78. How can you dominate anybody if you have 12 votes of 78? So this is really the way to do integration is I think the clue. But you may of course ask, but what about the Deutsche Mark? People say the Deutsche Mark dominates the European monetary system. And this is obviously a problem, no doubt about that. I mean, the policy of a central bank, which is in very close touch with your own federal system, is a wise one, and so I mean nobody has to complain actually, but still a dominating role of Deutsche Mark is a problem for somebody, for many people. The Deutsche Mark has a leading role in the European monetary system for one simple reason. That system is not yet integrated. It is still purely intergovernmental cooperation. It has no supranational institutions. There are no majority votes. And a system which is exclusively intergovernmental is by definition susceptible to a disproportionate influence of the strongest partner. So again, whoever is concerned about the Deutsche Mark and its, in quotation marks, dominating role, should press ahead with European Monetary Union and not curb it. And so again, I say the solution lies in integration. Well, let me conclude on this note. I think everybody, government and opposition alike in my country, is aware that that whatever the future structure of the European House or the European Order of Peace may be, the community is going to play a central role in it. The community is going to really to be the one of the cornerstones of that European House, or as the President of the Commission, Monsieur Delors, says, it is a central building in the European village. He prefers the expression European village, and I agree with it, but we always say European House, well, doesn't make such a difference. It is a central piece, and so one thing which you will see is we are not going to lessen our commitment to European integration. I'm pretty sure you will see that a unified Germany is even more committed to European integration. And let me conclude in saying what you are witnessing in Europe today is in no way any kind of move of Germany toward the East. What you are witnessing is Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, all moving west. That is the real movement in Europe, and so I think it will be for all the foreseeable future. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ambassador, everything that happens in this place is the result of the efforts and the initiatives of this larger group that we think of as the Miller Center family. So it's no accident that your host who made all of this possible, your visit and your stay here, should be given the opportunity, if he wishes, to ask the first question. Secretary Armitage?
My wife told me I didn't dare ask the first question.
Maybe the second or third.
I'll
Henry Theobald. It's this. In the event of near-term monetary unity between the East and the West, how does one mechanically take care of the problem of the destruction of the savings of the individuals, let's say, in the East, whose assets are denominated in Eastern marks?
Well, of course, any answer at this point in time is sheer speculation that cannot be otherwise. Mr. Pearl, who I think is respected over here as well as a good central banker, made a statement or gave a press conference yesterday or before yesterday and warned against any kind of speculation and said in particular the question of the exchange rate between the two Deutsche Mark East and West, whether 1-1 or 3-1 or 5-1 or what have you, is still quite open, and it would be very dangerous to speculate. The only thing he said, what the East Germans do to try to save the savings didn't make any sense, because the exchange rate they would get would anyway be better than the present rate on the black market. So what's not the black market, but the free market. The answer must by necessity lay on two levels. One level is of course the rate, and the other level is time. And the better the rate is, the more the whole thing will probably be stretched out in time. If the rate is 1-1, then I could not imagine that people would be able to change immediately, but probably would only be able to change within 5 or 6 or 8 years incremental way, so to speak. If the rate 5-1, maybe they could change everything immediately. So that is, you have variables here, and how in the end these variables will work out, it's impossible to say.
Next question.
Yes,
Bill Webb.
I have a little difficulty about sorting out what the major driving incentives are for reunification. I can see them easily from the standpoint of East Germany. They have reached almost total collapse. They are a real poor relation. From the standpoint of West Germany, with its enormous industrial, commercial, economic development, I don't know about population, but it must be a lot bigger for them to have done so much. They're taking over a poor relation and making it part of Germany. The economics of that, from the standpoint of West Germany, I have difficulty trying to see why it is so important and urgent, unless a lot of it is that they are both German and they have a natural drive that has lain dormant ever since statesmen divided up everything.
Repeat the question, or you can. They can't hear this question.
Some years ago, doing it wrong, of course, I believe. So I'm wondering, what are the major drives
for those of you
on West Germany?
For those of you in the outside room, the question was, what are the incentives and the major drives for West Germany in this reunification?
You used a very interesting word. You spoke about relatives. That's exactly the point. They are not just relatives. They are, how should I say it, they are ourselves. It is a feeling of identity. They are not cousins. Maybe you could say they are brothers. Certainly they not only belong to the same family, they belong to the inner circle of the same family, and we feel to be, for all emotionally, we feel to be identical. This came to many of us as a surprise. I mean, after 40 years of imposed separation, you had the feeling, for instance, that a city like Leipzig in Saxony was very far away. Somehow you felt it was Paris or Madrid or Rome were much closer by than Leipzig was. Leipzig was somewhere behind the hills, behind the mountains. And out of a sudden, all this changed. And people became aware that they really did not only belong together, but were just one people. And this was not a nationalistic emotion. Whoever has watched it on TV, when the wall came down in Berlin and all that, will, I think, agree with me that it was more like a festival. To me, one of the most significant scenes was when the border police on both sides suddenly started to drink champagne together. It was moving and funny at the same time. And I think that is the overwhelming feeling. Of course, you have some concerns, some economic concerns in the West. And I think you alluded to that. We will have to pay a price, and we have election year, and as always in election years, people do not want to raise taxes, so the first thing the government said, we'll finance all this without raising taxes. Whether this can be made or not remains to be seen. But on the whole, I would say a certain optimism, particular among our entrepreneurial people, the middle industry, big industry, certain optimism prevails. The overwhelming feeling, I would say, is this is a tremendous opportunity. We could have a second economic miracle. Incidentally, this is not limited to East Germany. This feeling includes, of course, Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, or business people see considerable chances in those markets, chances for investment and for outlets. So these are, I think, the main incentives. But it's very difficult to explain that. It is not so much a question of incentives which you could analyze, like on an operation table, like you dissect something. It happens. It is a happening which it's like a stream. I mean, you cannot you can try to build dams, but in the long run, I mean, it will continue to flow. It's like a stream. But let me once more say, it is in its manifestations, it is not a nationalistic event. It is much more like a great popular festival.
Other questions? Wilfred Grenfell?
I've read somewhere, or in a good many places, that the unification, I'm trying to supplement what he said, is going to put a considerable strain on West German finances, the social security system, plus a whole lot of other things. Is that true?
That may be true. I'm not a specialist. I could not give you any figures here. I think things are not yet sufficiently calculated anyway. But that may well be. The two social systems are very different, and of course it very much depends on how the reform is going to take place in East Germany, because reform of a revolutionary scale, of course, is needed. The whole system has to change. It's not only the planned economy, but let me give you one example again. A medical doctor in a hospital in East Germany would earn, well, about 800 Deutsche Mark Ost. And the same doctor, I mean an assistant medical doctor, would earn probably about 3,000 Deutsche Mark West. So you see a tremendous difference here. At the same time, the man in the East would have his apartment almost for nothing, would have public transportation almost for nothing, would have heavily subsidized things like food, not luxury goods, but normal food, etc., etc., etc. All this at tremendous cost for the government. Now that was one reason why the economy was so much run down. It was not only that the centrally planned economy didn't function. It was also that the state for years, for decades, delivered goods and goods and goods under the cost of production and paid with eating up the infrastructure, so to speak. You say, I think, capital disinvestment. I think it's a technical term. So all this has to change, and we are not yet in a position to calculate it. And I guess it will be a strain on our resources. But this brings me back to your point. The relation is 62 to 16 million. And so it's not quite, but roughly 1 to 4. And it would be ridiculous if we would not be able to handle it. We certainly will. I have no doubt about that.
Mr. Ambassador, I wonder if I could ask a question, not because I believe the assumptions of the question, but because I'd like to hear your comments.